Before answering these questions, a few words in connection with happiness may not be out of place. You know how the Buddha, and I quoted it today, said, "Cherish wife and child. That is the greatest blessing." In our world, and probably throughout the ages, cherishing wife and child, husband and child, father and mother and all the rest of them, had its difficulties and has its difficulties. And perhaps some of the deepest sorrow and suffering is associated with just this very problem. In all the scriptures of the world, which purport to present the creation of the world, they all teach one remarkably significant fact. I deliberately use the word fact. When they talk of a divine trinity, they present it as the absolute and the first emanation or manifestation of that is termed wisdom. And the next emanation of that is termed intelligence in the Kabbalah, for instance. Bina in the Kabbalah, Chokhmah in Kabbalistic terms. Ein Sof is the totality, the infinite. In the Sankhya philosophy, we have on the one hand Purusha, on the other hand Prakruti. In Kabbalistic terms, Bina or intelligence is the ultimate mother. In some of the apocryphal sayings with respect to Jesus, as he comes out of the Jordan, he says several things, amongst them these words, "My mother, the Holy Ghost." Bina contains within herself both positive and negative elements, not yet interacting. The male and the female are embodied potentially within the transcendent mother. Prakruti in the Sankhya philosophy also holds positive and negative, male and female, in supreme potentiality. Chokhmah, wisdom, by sheer presence, fecundates intelligence, Bina, in such a manner that the positive-negative elements get into interplay and the world evolves. Chokmah is wisdom, significant. When Jesus talks of the Father in heaven, Abba, he means he was a rabbi who was well acquainted with the deep teachings of the Kabbalah. He means Abba in Chokmah. And Abba, the first deep meaning, I should imagine, is the Son of the Unknown, the primordial, the origin of all things. But note the association with wisdom. In the Sankhya philosophy, Purusha, which means the person, and Prakruti, which means primordial nature, Purusha stimulates by mere presence, the influence of mere presence, the male-female, positive-negative, within Prakruti, primordial nature, mother nature. And that starts up the whole world process, and its evolution is said to produce consciousness also. Now, some scholars at least, in fact many scholars, have not quite understood this. And they have, their comments are rather misleading. Not that mine will not be misleading, but I trust they will be less misleading. Purusha means, and the hint is given in the greatest of the Upanishads, which philologists, of course, brush aside, quite justifiably, because they are just philologists. They don't see the devious ways which were sometimes employed in order to give the hint of supreme truth for him who would meditate upon it all. Purusha means he in whom all evil-mindedness has been burnt out. That is the meaning of the word person. The Buddha talks of the Uttara Purisu, the Supreme Person. Sri Krishna is referred to as the Purushottama, the Supreme, the Absolute Person. You see, you begin to see the significance. The one in whom all evil-mindedness is completely burnt out, by sheer presence, stimulates the duality, the dual operation of the one primordial creative energy. And as our president said in his talk last night, one begets two, two begets three, etc. All that takes place. This activity in Prakruti through the presence of Purusha, this activity in Bina through the presence of Chokmah, represents the primordial marriage made in heaven. Note, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. The wisdom in which resides Abba, the Father. Now you see, the implication there. There is no concupiscence involved in this stimulation. This is creation. And do remember that all that has been presented as universal creation, the cosmos emerges, and all that has been presented in terms of a God in heaven and archangels and angels and so forth, all comes out of your consciousness. They don't exist as blueprints, as prototypes, as wonderful shining entities flapping golden wings and playing golden harps and all the rest of it. Who wrote about these things? Who taught them? People like yourself and myself, in whom evil-mindedness had been burnt out. I'm not suggesting that in me the evil-mindedness has been burnt out, but you understand what I want to convey. So, this absence of concupiscence, of desire, desiderare, looking away from the light, is a noticeable feature that finer aspect of manas, which embodies transcendence in our own being, is capable of responding to this. Our sense of the moral imperative derives from that. Our sense of true, of Mahakaruna, of true Maitri, derives from that transcendent marriage made in heaven. In our own personal lives, the marriage made in heaven is represented when the masculine and feminine elements which exist in all human beings, male and female, are in perfect harmony with each other. Which means that in a man, the anima, the feminine part of him, and the conscious outward aspect of the masculine part are in perfect harmony, and in a woman, the animus, the masculine part of her, and the feminine part of her in her conscious physical life, you see, are in complete harmony with each other. Again, this involves the utter pacification and purification of the psyche. Now look, what makes people fall in love, as they say, and marry? The very phrase falling in love is a phrase which gives the game away. We are never out of the totality, the absoluteness of transcendent love and wisdom, because it is the whole universe, including the apparently visible, measurable, examinable material cosmos. We are never out of it. But if we can begin to see this and really thrill to it, it means that we can give ourselves wholly to that truth, which brings peace and comfort, strength. Comfort means fortis, strength. Brings spiritual strength and spiritual power, which is our omnipotence, into operation and activity. Now, if that consciousness can be tended and fostered, the problems of compatibility, of happiness, etc., could be seen in such a different light And if they are seen, really seen, by our whole inner consciousness, then they are an invisible power which harmonizes the discords. You see why a Buddha, why the perfected holy ones, why the old Brahman teachers, before they took any pupil, they always found out first, what is he like? Is he in harmony within himself, psychologically? The male side with the female side within his own being. Otherwise, if they saw that he wasn't that, they would tell him, live the life of the householder. Get free of all your sexual lumber. And then come and you can live the naturally and spontaneously celibate life. There's the celibacy within the psyche, within the soul, which every one of us can realize. And in realizing that, the difficulties can find, would have a better chance of being understood and resolved. This is an extremely difficult thing, because if you work out the implications of what I've tried to put before you, you will see the enormity of the task. The best thing is to be free of the desire to succeed, to put things right. The universe is right because it is naturally and spontaneously right. We have to do the same sort of thing. Now, here is one question. To see aversion in the impersonal situation is relatively easy. For example, the drunken man, which I talked about yesterday. But in closer relationships, seeing the aversion and anger without retaliation, to be continuous, calculated, cruel, unkind, dreadful deeds directed straight at us does not solve the problem. The suggestion here is that one may have to retaliate. It actually seems to invite worse violence. What then? Unquestionably an extremely difficult problem. It's not at all easy. If somebody with whom we are constantly associated by virtue of our situation and our circumstance is deliberately or even undeliberately, thoughtlessly, going to hurt us all the time, we are up a gum tree, as one may say, and we are stuck there. The ideal solution, the counsel of perfection, is pay complete attention to the transformation of one's own mode of awareness. One's own consciousness exercises an invisible, unanalyzable influence upon circumstance. when the individual living the holy life has really outgrown some, at least, of his limitations and emerged into a deeper state of consciousness which functions naturally and spontaneously without his brain knowing it, then it is an extraordinary thing to observe, and I've seen this myself. It changes the external circumstances. You know, we have the wonderful teaching of the Brahma Viharas in Buddhist teaching. But ordinarily, we do not really understand how it operates. We are told to suffuse the other person with metta, with karuna, with mudita, and so on. Well, precisely how do you suffuse another person with maitri? Just precisely what do you do? Most people just go through a verbal ritual, which is impotent, quite impotent. And most people will attempt a way out, desiring to produce a result which is agreeable to themselves, which is premeditated. It may be that the simplest solution in terms of action, physical action, would be to go away somewhere or send the other person out if you can. But sending the other person out is an act which comes under the category of hate. You can send yourself out, you can withdraw. But if you withdraw in the ordinary way, you have turned your attention away from a psychical force which is still actually operating in your own psyche. We use that phrase, forgive and forget. You can't do that sort of thing. It just doesn't really operate. The transformation of your own mode of consciousness is perhaps the ideal thing. Because amongst other consequences which will come about through the transformation of your own mode of awareness is that your sensitivity will remain unimpaired to what is hurtful, but your reactivity to it will dissolve away. You know, this is not at all easy. I am a human being like any ordinary person in the world, a very ordinary person. And in my young years, I have known a good deal about all this. But the reactivity dissolves because you see light through the transformation of your own consciousness, through the vanishing of the desiderare, the looking away from the light. And then it has an extraordinary influence upon the other person. Of course, if that other person is really dumb, altogether dumb, and insensitive, you can't do anything about it. Unless, as I say, you can go away. Wait patiently until he or she dies. But the power of karuna, the true karuna, is tremendous. And unless there is that change in consciousness, true karuna cannot operate. It just is a verbal ritual. The power behind feeling depends upon your consciousness. What is your consciousness like? That is the source of the dynamic energy. Because it's the creative power of the universe which comes into operation then. Now, this good person did not sign, but I can see from the language who the person is. Please speak to us about detachment. I know that to be detached does not mean to be cut off, but it is difficult not to feel so. There is a feeling that to be detached should be to be living with and in all but the difficult. There is a feeling that to be detached should be to be living with and in all. But the difficulty is to see how this can be achieved, if indeed there is achievement in it. Speak to us about detachment. It's a case of using words which are less misleading. Instead of saying detachment, say non-attachment. This is a universe, and the word universe means that every person and everything in it is completely interrelated with all the rest. You can't take a knife or something and cut any one thing out of the cosmos. You can't get rid of anything at all. You can transform it. You cannot get rid of evil, as I said yesterday. You can transform evil. Evil is only a disharmonious expression of your own psychical life energy. You can get rid of a liver or part of the liver or a kidney or something like that by an operation. But can you operate on a psyche? The psyche functions as a whole. The whole being displaying this kind of mentality, of thought and feeling. That's the psyche. That's a psychical thing. It's a whole thing. There are no organs for the psyche. Now, therefore, not to be detached, to be cut off, because that gives not quite the right understanding. Non-attachment, which means non-grasping. Relationships are there permanently. They are always there. The nature of those relationships, the way they function, change. And one of the great factors which makes for harmonious relationships is non-attachment, which means you do not grasp. You do not limit, therefore. You do not possess. You have no ulterior motives with respect to that. You have no vested interest in that. Because all these things are limiting factors. They are factors which produce disharmony. So, non-attachment. You might ask, well, how do I cultivate non-attachment? By being fully attentive all the time. Attentive to what comes to you through the sense avenues, and attentive to the tendency for reactivity from out of your own brain to those impressions. Now, if you are just wholly aware of it, without saying, I want this, I don't want this, without passing condemnatory judgments upon it, because that's an act of aversion, of hate, but seeing the thing for what it is, yes, this promotes welfare, and this produces disharmony. Just really see it like that, with complete intensity of perception, and then the dissolution of the limitations produced by grasping and so forth all diminish and disappear. Then you are non-attached. That doesn't mean that you are insensitive or indifferent. This word which we have in the Buddhist teachings, upekkha, as the fourth element in the presentation of the wonderful teaching of the Brahma Viharas, the teaching of, if you like to use an ordinary, very loaded English word, love. That fourth element is one of the profoundest teachings that has come into being. It is pre-Buddhistic, remember. It isn't original to the Buddha. It is pre-Buddhistic. You'll find it in the older writings. And also it is mentioned in a very casual, by the way, manner in Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms. Very interesting. Of course, Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms are post-Buddhistic. But whilst the aphorisms are post-Buddhistic, the actual teaching, as it was handed down from yogi to yogi, to would-be yogi, are pre-Buddhistic. Definitely pre-Buddhistic. So, let us pass on to the next question. Yesterday you said, don't reject life, make whole, holy. Would you please say more about the healing aspect of living an harmonious life? Surely, hasn't a good deal already been said about the healing which is brought about through living the holy life? Let us just touch again upon some of the essential elements concerned with it. Where that which is ill is concerned, the world in the ordinary way will offer counteraction or a palliative. A palliative is just dope, a tranquilizer, the effects whereof, and your dis-ease very often is worse than it ever was before. So palliatives are useless. Counteraction simply means conflict. This, in order to destroy that, to get rid of it. It means conflict. It doesn't mean a true resolution of the discord into a condition of harmony. That means, therefore, that it isn't true healing, whole making. The word healing, the whole idea of whole making, of holiness, is something that is completely associated with the totality of life and the living process. Life is immortal, but as we can see it and experience it, are the temporal manifestations of eternal life. You know, in the Chandogya Upanishad, you have that wonderful statement, Brahman is prana, life. Life in every sense, not merely the biological. If Brahman is prana, and Brahman is the absolute all, then life is eternal, not subject to the limitations of finitude or mortality or the time process. So healing means to make whole in that sense, to restore to perfect, healthy livingness. If we understand that, we will see that this perfect livingness comes out of a transcendent depth. It comes out of this extraordinary action in eternity of the primordial creative energy, out of which has emerged the entire process. Not only within ourselves and in terms of our own consciousness, but in terms of what we call the material universe also. So, you find that the great religious teachers always gave their answer to any question, to any problem, from out of the context of the transcendent, not out of the context of finitude and mortality, out of the context of the eternal and the immortal. It's a very significant thing. Look through all the great religious teachings and you will find that that is the case. Did a single one of the great world teachers or the great spiritual teachers propound a system of philosophy, propound a political science or an economic science or all that petty little stuff which bedevils our lives? All these things emerge and function at our own dualistic, conflicting level. But the whole making power, the creative power as such, comes out of the transcendent, the unknown, and by the brain, the unknowable. The brain being just the concretest expression of mind. So, the healing aspect of living the harmonious life, I think I've said enough there.